From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, we look at the race for governor.
There is just not a huge amount of excitement to get out the vote. And we know from past years that when it's a non-presidential year, Democrats don't turn out as much as Republicans do.
How Michigan's emergency manager law compares to other states.
You won't see emergency managers in North Carolina because they hover. They are there in the business, in the books of their local municipalities, trying to prevent these situations.
Plus, Michigan writers inspired by the lakes.
Being near water, the fluidity of water, that whole aesthetic sense of who I am is related to water.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. In just 3 years, the number of Michigan cities and school districts run by a state-appointed emergency manager has ballooned from 6 to 17. How effective is Michigan's EM law? How does it measure up to similar laws in other states? I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's Stateside, we'll take a deep dive into Michigan's emergency manager law. We'll see how communities can avoid sliding back into financial trouble once the EM's term is up. But first, it's your chance to ask questions of Mark Schauer, the Democrat who wants to be your next governor. That happens tomorrow morning at 9, right here on Michigan Radio. Rick Pluta and Zoe Clark, the co-hosts of Michigan Radio's It's Just Politics, are here to tell us more. Hi, Rick. Hi, Zoe.
Hello.
Hi, Cindy.
Rick, what issues are Mark Schauer and Governor Snyder focusing on now?
The governor is basically focusing on the state's economic recovery, the fact that overall the trend in job numbers is improving, not at a super fast rate, but it is improving. He's calling Michigan the comeback state. And the Schauer campaign and the Democrats are being a little bit more focused in terms of what they're talking about. Certainly charter schools, because of the Detroit Free Press series that found a lot of problems in how Michigan manages charters, has become an issue of late. We're also seeing, what the legislature did, recently as far as the petition initiated law that outlaws abortion coverage as part of basic insurance policies. You have to buy a rider policy if you're going to get that coverage, that they're trying to make that an issue. And then there's more globally the issues of spending on schools, on education, and lifting the exemption on pensions for the purposes of taxing incomes.
What are you saying, Zoe?
I think Rick is absolutely right. The issue has been for the Schauer campaign, though, is not necessarily being able to break through with all of those issues. And one of the things that the Schauer campaign has to do if it is going to win this race is get out the vote among Democrats. And right now, there is just not a huge amount of excitement to get out the vote. And we know from past years that when a president is not at the top of the ticket, when it's a non-presidential year, Democrats don't turn out as much as Republicans do. Lon Johnson, the chair of the Democratic Party here in Michigan, he is really pushing for turnout. He says he wants to get 800,000 voters out to the polls. I just don't think right now that Mark Schauer is creating enough excitement to get anywhere near that number.
Well, I have to say, I've seen one TV ad for Mark Schauer, and it is not running very frequently, whereas the Terry Lynn Land versus Gary Peters ads are incessant. Why aren't they doing more to break through, through advertising and media awareness to the voters?
Well, because first of all, the Schauer campaign itself does not have a lot of money. So they're sitting on it until after the August primary and saving it for the general election. They're taking money from the Fund for Publicly Financing Campaigns, where the governor is not. So Schauer is really relying on the Democratic Governors Association to do essentially surrogate spending on advertising on his behalf. I'll point out it's anecdotal, but one of the things that we found when we sent reporters out all across the state to ask people what they'd like to ask the candidates for governor, that we had a fair number of responses of people just saying,
who is Mark Schauer? Yeah, which I think right now, it's July. Maybe that's not incredibly worrisome. Rick and I like to pay attention to this kind of stuff, maybe even too closely, I will admit. But if you're still hearing that kind of thing come fall, come September, early October, that's a serious problem.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's clearly, I mean, one thing that we are seeing, and this is bearing out in a lot of the public opinion research, is let's just say that Mark Schauer has room to grow in terms of public identification.
Is that what you're going to be looking for as the summer campaign season moves on?
Absolutely. And Cindy, I think you hit on something interesting where you were talking about the Peters and Terry Lynn uh-huh. Land race. I think that what we're going to see is more attention being paid on that race now, that Democrats might just say, look, we're not sure we can win with Schauer. Let's put all of our effort into Peters or most of our effort. And there's going to be some national groups that agree because this Peters-Terry Lynn Land seat is one that Republicans are looking to gain so that they can win 6 and take back the U.S. Senate. So there's going to be national money coming into that race. So that's going to be an interesting dynamic to watch, too.
I think that latter point is actually the driver on this, that there's just a lot more national interest in who's going to control the United States Senate, and the Peters Land race is might be, you know, one of the critical points in that. Internally within the state, a lot of Democrats are looking to Gary Peters
yep.
to be the ticket leader who will convince Democrats that it's worthwhile to get out
in
and
fact
vote.
Just quickly, I got word just this morning that apparently Bill Clinton is scheduled maybe even to come in next week to campaign for Peters. So I think that shows you the level of national attention
Joe
that race
Biden is
going
to be making an appearance in the state next
yep.
week. So.
Yep. So that looks like that will be our summer as we move ahead, and then maybe we'll see more action in the governor's race after the primary.
I would expect so.
And we'll also keep an eye if any debates actually happen. I mean, Cindy, we're talking about this call-in that Schauer will be participating in tomorrow. But this is not a debate. It's not a joint appearance. Schauer, you know, what we tend to see is the underdogs want the debates. And Snyder is saying, I'm not quite sure if I necessarily need that right now. So
well, Snyder's not saying that, although undoubtedly they're thinking that.
Yeah.
But that's also, you know, one of the reasons that we decided to use this format of a statewide call-in show is that in Michigan, what happens with debates is everyone puts in their requests, and then the campaigns go and negotiate with each other on which ones they're going to accept and what the terms are going to be, what can be talked about, how the questions can be answered, whether or not there are follow-ups and the candidates can address each other. And the candidates really control the show. Michigan,
absolutely.
Unlike a lot of other states, do not have command performance debates for the people who want to serve them in public office.
Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, co-hosts of It's Just Politics. As always, thank you so much.
As always, our pleasure.
Thank you, Cindy.
And again, Rick Pluta will be hosting a special statewide call-in show with Mark Schauer tomorrow morning at 9 here on Michigan Radio. You can check our Facebook page for details on the number for you to call in. And we should note, an invitation has certainly been extended to Governor Snyder for an hour-long call-in as well. A new appraisal of the Detroit Institute of Arts collection has found the works could be worth anywhere from $2.7 billion up to $4.6 billion. Now, that's a mighty big difference from the $866 million value that Christie's put on the collection last fall. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes is with us now. Daniel, could this new appraisal by ArtVest Partners torpedo the grand bargain?
I think that question is first going to have to be answered by the vote of the pensioners, which on the grand bargain, which the deadline is tomorrow for that ballots to be in California. And so we should know within about a week to 10 days, from what I understand, whether the majority of both classes of pensioners have accepted the grand bargain. If that happens, I think we then, to your more direct question, we go into a confirmation trial next month, and I think it's certain that these valuations are going to be argued about by other creditors, not by the pensioners if they've accepted the deal. So then you've got the pensioners, the grand bargainers, as it were, have the pensioners on their side. Mm. You know, this is very interesting. You pointed out at the top that Christie's valued at $866. That's true, but that was only 5% of the collection. This was an attempt to value the entire 66,000 pieces that are held by the DIA. So it's really a kind of an apples and oranges comparison. I think when you dig into it a little bit more, you realize that big $4.6 billion number has a lot of caveats attached to it. Like if you tried to sell big chunks of this collection at the same time, you'd likely depress prices dramatically.
Yeah, and actually, I guess the report itself even said a lot of that collection is in stuff like old master and 19th century European paintings and pre-1950s American art. And those are areas that are kind of out of favor with collectors anyway. So there's the appraise thing, and then there's the real world value?
I think that's right. I mean, it's just like selling your home. I mean, you can put your house on the market and say it's appraised at X hundreds of thousands of dollars, but if somebody's not willing to pay that, you can stamp your feet. You're still not going to get that money if they're not willing to pay it. It's really that simple. And I think when you have a glut on the market of art, all from a similar time period, that could be the kind of problem that you have. I think what's really important for people to remember here is all of this is about how do you extract value from the DIA's art, right? Mm-hmm. One way you do that is you'd go out and try to sell it, and you'd sell it to whoever the highest bidder. You'd sell it to, you know, somebody from Saudi Arabia or China or Russia or India, and in fact, those people from those parts of the world were what really kind of drove up prices in the previous decade. They've kind of, that's leveled off now. But the grand bargain also is something that is using the art to raise cash and create value. They're just doing it in a different way. They're not selling it. They are raising cash from different constituencies within Southeast Michigan, the foundation community, the state of Michigan, DIA donors. And they're doing it to the benefit of the pensioners.
But you do say later in your story, the forward march of the grand bargain, if approved by the pensioners, is assuming a momentum all of its own.
Well, I think it is. If you get the sense here, I mean, this is a real bipartisan effort in around here. You've had a real coming together of a lot of disparate groups. You've had foundations that are doing things that and stretching their missions far beyond what they've ever done before, just because they see this as a singular opportunity and a potential crisis at the same time. You've got Republican leadership in the state legislature that is backed money for the grand bargain, in part because they think it's a cheaper way to go than run the risk of a more devastating settlement to pensioners, which potentially could put them more on the social services rolls, for particularly those who are not as well compensated, depending on when they retired, how old they are, et cetera. So I think this is kind of their attempt to try and shore this thing up. I think a lot of people would look at this and say this is a very unlikely coalition to come together and save and try to rescue a portion of Detroit's bankruptcy.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. As always, thanks, Daniel.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The latest report card on jobs in America points to a country continuing to recover from the Great Recession. The national unemployment rate fell to 6.1%. That's the lowest level since September 2008. Just what does the June jobs report tell us about Michigan? Where have we made gains and where are we still hurting? University of Michigan labor economist Don Grimes is here. Don, did you like what you saw in the June labor report?
Yes, it was a very strong report. As you noted in your introduction, the unemployment rate fell to 6.1%. In the nation, we created almost 300,000 jobs. We don't have the June data yet for Michigan. But it should be a good number for Michigan as well.
What do you look for, Don, when you review all of those numbers? There's so much offered up. What are you really looking for?
Well, I think the jobs, we're creating jobs at a pretty good clip now. So I don't think it's actually a jobs problem, although that gets a lot of attention, and certainly by politicians, they always talk about jobs. What really is sort of the negative aspect of growth in the United States right now is that wages, real wages, adjusted for inflation, are not increasing. They're basically flat. Maybe they're growing up a couple of tenths of percentage point a year. If you look at compensation, which includes non-wage benefits, that's growing a little stronger. But if you go back, you know, to 2010, even real wage compensation is growing less than 1% a year, and that's actually pretty depressing.
So do you think that the numbers we saw from June, as you say, they're positive, but do you think they point to a recovery that is picking up steam, or is it kind of stumbling along?
I think it's probably more struggling along. I mean, we're creating a lot of jobs. The jobs are not really the problem. where I think we're running out of steam, or where I think the real problem, again, is in the wages, which are really linked to the fact that we're not getting the output growth, the GDP growth, which actually fell by 2.9% in the first quarter. And that's actually the largest non-recession-related decline that we've had in the in like 60 years. So that's actually a very negative effect. And we're just not getting output growth, even though we're getting job growth. And when you don't get output growth, it's really hard to get any sort of wage growth or compensation growth.
So it sounds like there's a soft, concerning underbelly to this pretty positive report.
Yes. If we don't get productivity growth accelerating, I mean, we had productivity growth of 0.4% in 2011, up to 1.4% in 2012, 0.9% in 2013, and through the first quarter of this year, we're probably at zero or maybe negative because the data hasn't yet been adjusted for the big decline in GDP. And those are really bad numbers from a historical perspective. And if we don't get productivity growth to start increasing, the amount of output per worker, then we're not going to be able to get increases in the real wage going forward. And this is really critical. If you get productivity growing at 2 to 2.5% a year, then everybody's standard of living is going to double in about every 35 years. But if you're getting productivity growth that's less than 1%, then it's going to take 100 years for us to double our standard of living, and all of that will be in actually medical benefits. So most people don't sort of appreciate that
No.
as much as an increase in their standard of living as they do their pay. And so productivity growth is really a key concern, and the fact that it's been really weak in this recovery, much weaker than the jobs, which gets all the attention, of course, but it's really productivity growth that concerns me.
And what do you think it would take to goose that productivity?
Now that's a great question. And my real concern is that there may not be anything we can do. Mm-hmm. It could be, and there are some economists who are sort of studying this, a few economists who are spent a lot of effort in this, and one of their possible ideas is essentially that we've sort of run out of technological innovations that could really goose productivity. And there's also a potential problem with sort of our aging. Basically, you've got these aging baby boomers. And unfortunately, as we age, we're not as productive, unfortunately. So our productivity, our most productive years are usually in our 40s and 50s, and a lot of people are sort of aging out of that and still remaining in the workforce. So there may not be anything we can do. It may be sort of a structural problem, where somehow all of these technological advantages in terms of smartphones, in terms of medical procedures, maybe they really don't boost productivity. Although, again, another question is maybe some of these gains are sort of not appropriately counted in the GDP accounts. In other words, we get a better quality of life, even if it doesn't show up as increased output. And that may be, maybe our GDP numbers are understating the well-being. Maybe we're actually doing better. But if they were doing better, I think people would be happier than they are. People aren't very happy right now.
University of Michigan economist Don Grimes, always good to talk with you, Don. Thank you for kind of reviewing those June employment numbers with us.
You're welcome.
If you live in Michigan, water isn't far away. The Great Lakes, one of Michigan's 11,000 inland lakes, a river like the Manistee or Ausable. Traverse Magazine invited 5 Northern Michigan women writers to share their thoughts on water. 2 of those writers join us now from Interlochen Public Radio. Anne-Marie Ullman, thank you so much for being here.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Fleta Brown, welcome to Stateside.
Hi, I'm glad to be here.
What Michigan water spot is most special to you and why, Anne-Marie?
Well, we live very near Empire Beach, which is on the coast of Lake Michigan, and that's the water that I grew up with, and that's the water that's in my spirit, and yeah, that's the place. It's Lake Michigan, that big water.
What about you, Fleta?
Well, mine's the little water, Intermediate Lake. It's about 7 miles long, but it's pretty narrow. It's part of the chain of lakes in Antrim County. Bel Air is on one end, and the little town of Central Lake is on the other.
How does Northern Michigan and the water inspire you? Anne-Marie?
Well, I grew up on a farm, so water is essential. You know, agriculture it relies totally on water. So there's that part of it. But it's also, I think, an aesthetic and spiritual quality that helped shape my being. It's being near water, the fluidity of water, that whole aesthetic sense of who I am is related to water. It's in all of us, but I think for those of us who understood from the very beginning the reliance of agriculture and farms on water, it's an interior thing.
Fleta?
Well, I spent practically every summer of my young life up here. And water to me, I just have these memories of driving up from Arkansas where it was incredibly hot and getting closer and closer to the lake and the woods and the water. And the first glint of water I saw through the trees it was like a miracle. And water has always felt like a miracle to me. There's nothing I like better than being near water. I've always tried every single place we've ever lived that I've been really happy living there has been near water.
How does Northern Michigan and the waters of Northern Michigan contribute to who you are as a writer, Fleta?
I think if you look at my poems and essays, there's water in almost everything. There's just water everywhere. Water is it just shows up. It's so deep into my nature that I can hardly write without referring to water sometime or other.
What about you, Anne Marie?
It's the same. It permeates the language always. In the last book, An American Map, there are three or four essays that center on an interaction with water that are focused primarily on water, but it's also just everywhere in the language. And I also think sometimes it's in the sentences, in the flow of the sentences, and that feeling of liquidity in the language. So that's a part of it, too.
Anne Marie, the essay you published in Traverse Magazine is entitled A Dozen Waves, and it explores the way you dealt with your father's death through your relationship with Lake Michigan. Would you read us an excerpt?
Oh, I'd love to. Thank you for asking. This is the last two sections, and this is the final two waves that I explore. This is the wave of evening, one that quiets. Out there on the board, as the temperature dropped, the moment when I felt him, his spirit, east wind, flying over waves, intensely curious, beyond these waves, into the waves, beyond, beyond. I tried to match and rode the waves so hard I was almost beyond seeing the shore. The blue there was deep and fast and pure. The wave told me he was fine. I stopped. Pulled back to earth. O lake, O father, O woman on the water, take this water I am made of and depend on. Keep it pure and blue, this healing liquid held in a body of being, lifeblood that comes in the shape of waves.
I have to say that's lovely. You've actually made me cry as I listen to that because I'm thinking about my own father. So that was really, sure. Really, really beautiful. The lake so healing to your grief?
Well, I was, after my father died, as part of my coping, I started to paddleboard. And the paddleboard, getting out there on the water, close to the water, in those big expanses by myself, was the best therapy in the world. The water has a serenity and a spirituality that I was able to connect with, and that began my healing.
Fleta, your essay is entitled Whaler, and it takes us back to when you're rowing on Intermediate Lake in Antrim County with your cousin Alan when you were kids. Would you read us a portion?
Sure. The joy of water is its resistance that never becomes intractability. In a strong wind, your muscles burn from trying to make a little headway measured by the trees on shore. On a glassy lake, water shows you where you've been in ever-widening rings. You carve it. You bless or cuss your oars. If they're the old heavy wood ones, your palms begin to redden and sting. The oarlocks rattle and thunk. If they're the newer plastic ones, your arms seem to fly upward out of the water. The oarlocks manage only a tinny click. If you've greased them too much, the oar pins can fly out. Since you row facing backward, you see the past. You have to look over your shoulder to see the future, but you can't keep your head turned that way for long because you'll get a crick in your neck, so you just glance to keep yourself going in the direction you intend and to keep from hitting anything. This requires a different sort of awareness, based partly on trust and partly on seeing what you've already done, for good or ill.
That brings back lots of very, very good memories as well. Fleeta, we've all seen the Pure Michigan ads that present this gorgeous view of our state and its nature and the water. And we know that view is designed to bring in tourists and their dollars. And I'm wondering, how does that square with your experience of really living there and calling Northern Michigan and its waters home?
Well, of course, I didn't call it home until we actually moved to Traverse City after we retired. I would have loved to have called it home earlier, but I was teaching in Delaware. But it's different. I'm just delighted to have the water so close to me all the time and to have our little lake so close all the time. And I couldn't say exactly, except I have to say it may be different, but I never, ever have lost that sense of just pure joy and magic that every time I look at the water, when I look at the bay and the sun is shining and it's all glistening, and when I'm at the lake and no matter what the sea, the water's doing, I'm just overjoyed to be there and watch it. I used to sit out on the end of the dock when I was a kid, and I'd get a paint-by-numbers set that had water in it, and I'd try to follow what the numbers were doing with the colors in the lake, and I'd end up doing my own instead of using the paint the way that we're supposed to, because I was so interested in the different shades of color in the water.
And Anne-Marie, meaning that idea, what's that experience of calling this corner of Michigan home? How does that compare to the tourist view?
I think that the commerce of water is important, but I think more important is the commons of water. And I love that sense of being ecocentric with the water instead of egocentric. You know, I like that sense of being present to the water. And what Fleet is saying is absolutely true, that there's this joy that comes from being near it and watching it in all of its moods. I think our tourist industry, you know, nurtures a summer attitude. And many times I think about what it's like in the fall or what it's like in the early spring when the ice just goes out. And all of that is metaphorical and beautifully rich for, you know, the people who can live there and be near it and watch it. And it's also a guide, you know, a metaphorical guide for us. You know, it teaches us, it takes us in and it teaches us how to be, I think, when you're present to water.
Michigan writers Anne-Marie Ullman and Fleeta Brown, their essays on their love of water in Michigan are in the current issue of Traverse Magazine. Thank you so much to both of you for being with us and for sharing your writing with us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Thanks so much.
Yeah.
It's one of the top tourist destinations in the state, so why shouldn't Traverse City have its own song? And what better time to premiere that song than during the National Cherry Festival? This year's winner of the Traverse City Tourism Song Search is a number called Take Me There from the group The Hacky Turtles. The band will unveil their song this Saturday during the big parade for the Cherry Festival. The Hacky Turtles is a funk reggae fusion band. The four members are all from Traverse City area high schools. Take Me There gives a nod to cherries, food, sunshine, and good people. They'll be posting a video of the Traverse City song on traversecity.com and also the Pure Michigan Facebook page. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In just 3 years, the number of Michigan cities and school districts run by a state-appointed emergency manager has ballooned from 6 to 17. Just how effective is Michigan's emergency manager law, and how does it stack up to similar laws in other states? And how can communities avoid sliding back into financial trouble once the emergency manager's term is up? Bridge Magazine writer Chastity Pratt-Dossie explores these questions in a report for the newest Bridge Magazine. Chastity, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you.
And we welcome back Lou Schimmel. Lou has served as emergency financial manager or emergency manager for eCourse, Hamtramck, and Pontiac. Right now, he's on the Transition Advisory Board for Pontiac. And good to have you back on the program, Lou.
It's always a pleasure.
Chastity, I want to start by having you address the fact that it appears from your piece there's very little middle ground when it comes to having an emergency manager. People seem to either be very relieved that the state is taking over, or they feel that EMs like Lou are kind of like Darth Vader.
Definitely so. It nine times out of 10 results in a really visceral and emotional response from residents, because what we see as far as people who don't like it, they'll say, look, you're taking away the voting rights here because our elected officials no longer have power. This state guy has all the power. And that definitely gets people really riled up. And those who say it's a good idea, they're less emotional. You know, they're more a little quiet. So
the noise comes from the ones
who... The noise comes from the people who don't like it.
Well, how much do you think this antagonism toward any emergency manager these days is based on the fact that Michigan voters said no to the EM law in that 2012 referendum, and then the legislature and the governor turned around a month later and said, well, basically, here's your new version, and by the way, we've made it referendum-proof.
Well, in those cities, let's just talk about Detroit. Let's just say it. Detroit has the emergency manager for the city and emergency manager for the school district, and they have really loud critics and emotional protesters. And in some of the smaller areas like Allen Park, they have, you know, smaller amounts of people who are against it. But definitely the fact that there was the law, Public Act 4, and people said, no, we don't want it by ballot referendum. And then a few weeks later, the legislature said, okay, you don't want Public Act 4, we'll give you a different emergency manager law. And this one is actually a little bit tougher. So all of that plays into the emotional response, people saying, I don't like it. At the same time, the legislature and the governor have said, well, this is what we need to do because we are having tough times and a lot of our communities are facing emergencies.
Well, I just want to say two things. You know, this democracy thing comes up a lot, and it's certainly a good thing to have come up. But I think there's two things we have to keep in mind here. Number one is the governor was certainly elected by the voters of Michigan. The legislature was elected by the voters of Michigan. The emergency manager law was passed by, you know, the voters by the legislature and the governor. And I think the state has a duty to see to it that its municipalities, which get their authority from the state of Michigan, act fiscally responsible. And I think the second thing about that whole democracy argument is, you know, what do we say about communities who have leaders who, you know, none of us like to talk about this, but we all know it's true. I mean, we have some leaders in some of these communities that have their hands in the cookie jar, and worse. And these communities, some of them, refuse to change their ways of operating. They continue to fiscally operate in an irresponsible way. And as a result of that, the communities that don't want to change and they want to continue to act in that fashion, it ends up with the rest of us in the state of Michigan being pushed into the situation where we're being asked to subsidize mismanagement. I mean, that's just kind of the flip side of some of this. I mean, mm-hmm. I think there's some pretty good reasons why the Emergency Manager Act makes a lot of sense.
Well, very definitely. Again, we have communities that are facing really tough times and have made some poor decisions leading up into the emergency management. But what our story on Bridge talks about is, you know, look at a state like North Carolina. They have an intervention law, a receivership law. They can take over their local governments when they have problems. But you won't see emergency managers in North Carolina because they hover. They are there in the business, in the books of their local municipalities, trying to prevent these situations. Here in Michigan, everyone talked about, well, Detroit, you know, they're making some poor decisions. They don't have the revenue that they need from taxes. And the state saw this disaster coming. And, you know, why can't we be like North Carolina? You know?
Why can't we be hovering a little bit more?
Can't we be more interactive beforehand? We need to consider what other states are doing to prevent the situations that we have going on here.
But Lou, having worked in E-Course in Hamtramck and Pontiac, so you've been there in the city halls, do you think municipalities resent the hovering?
Well, certainly municipalities that don't want to change, as I said, certainly resent the hovering. And it's a mixed bag like your program started out. There's a real strong contingent in Pontiac. Of course, I grew up in Pontiac, mm-hmm. so I know a lot of the people there. There's a really strong group that was just delighted that finally somebody came in and was going to clean up what they considered to be a mess. And then there's the other group that says, you know, we're here. We don't want you in here running our city. And, you know, there's strong feelings on both sides. The reason I like the new law, and I think Chastity made the point on another occasion, where I think we have the strongest law of, what, 23 states, Chastity?
Yes.
That was it? We have the strongest law. But my feeling on that is I was in E-Course for 5 years. I was in Hamtramck for 5 years. And I was in Pontiac, which was a much more severe situation, for less than 2 years. So I argue if you're going to have an act, you might as well have one that's strong enough where an emergency manager can get in, do his job, and get out. So, I mean, I like the fact that we have the strongest act. I think if you're going to have one, you might as well have one that works.
The question remains, okay, here in Michigan, we love home rule. We love our local control. And, yes, the local governments are a creature of the state. But as such, does the state have some prevention responsibilities here? You know, people want local control. But if you're a creature of the state, doesn't the state have some responsibility to help you along the way instead of, you
letting
know, ground you,
slide
after,
off the cliff.
after you slide off the cliff?
I agree. A good point. And I do believe, and maybe, Jesse, you know more than I do about this. I haven't really, I always get there at the end, never at the beginning. But I believe Act 436 does build in a lot of new things that weren't in the previous acts about prevention and doing some work ahead of time before to prevent these kinds of situations. I do know that the state treasury, because I work with them a lot, has been doing a lot of work regarding municipalities that are in trouble prior to an emergency manager or the whole process starting. And also, the state is doing, of course, as a result of Act 436, a lot afterwards as well that never was done before, because I walked out of E-Course and I walked out of Hamtramck, and that was it. Nothing mm-hmm. else happened.
And they
and
slid
they
back into deficit, yes.
Now, this transition board, I believe, is working very well in Pontiac and in other communities. That there's only been one or two others, but I think it's a good process that'll keep in place the many changes that were made during the emergency manager time.
Lou, give us a sense of what is the transition advisory board's role? How much power do you have because you're doing that now in Pontiac?
We have no power to run the city as the transition board. We do have the power to review everything that's done by the mayor and council. As
and
a
reject
result
some
of, the,
of it, right?
Yeah.
So that's
we
power.
Oversee it. We oversee it. So if the mayor and council does something, we don't then pass something on our own. We simply say what you did is unacceptable, because it'll throw the budget that's in place out of balance, or it's not a balanced budget. Go back, look at it again, and come back with something that is acceptable. There's definitely that's the whole idea.
Oversight
to make sure that it doesn't fall back.
The question that remains, and Lou, you and I talked a bit about it with when we talked about this story, is, okay, where is the transition as far as helping the local officials and government participate in the transition? Really, what it comes down to is, if you're going to take over a place, if you're going to get the budget back into the black, once you hand over the reins to the people who are going to take it forward, how do we know that they are prepared, trained,
involved,
competent, know how this fix was done so that they can sustain it? Sustainability is really the question here.
Because you don't want to see what happened in E-Course and Hamtramck.
And when we know that more and more cities are facing hard times, and we will likely see this law put into effect, how do we guarantee, or as much as we can, make sure there's some sustainability and involve people in it so the political gameplay is minimized?
The way we do that is the way we did it, which I feel we did in Pontiac, is I had a chief assistant who basically was a city manager that was with me all during the emergency manager process. I left him there when I left, and he was having meetings on a weekly basis, and depending on what the subject was, or a monthly basis, with the mayor and council people as training sessions. and education sessions regarding budget matters and so on. So he is still there now. The mayor in Pontiac now would like to have her own person there. The process for hiring that person is in place, but the emergency manager assistant guy who is there now will stay there and continue to do his education process until he feels it's time that, you know, they're adequately educated and can do the job on their own. So we didn't just walk out. We left everybody in place, and it's a gradual change as people leave. The mayor can bring in her own people. It isn't just sort of a sudden, all of a sudden we go from this to that, which was the case in Ecorse and Hamtramck when I left.
Now, we started our conversation, Chester, you brought up Detroit, and I'd like you to give us your ideas as far as what do you see in Detroit now with Kevin Orr, with Mayor Mike Duggan, that gives you clues as to how things will go once Kevin Orr's term is up this fall. Lou, let me have you start with that.
I think, Mike Duggan is there. Mike Duggan has said he, you know, really wants everybody gone. He wants to be able to run the city himself. I'm wondering if he really is. I'm not saying he's not telling the truth, but I think Mike Duggan has no chance at all until Kevin Orr finishes his job, because much of what has to be done in the bankruptcy court, and I think you need to get all of that stuff behind you before Mike Duggan has a chance to run the city. But, of course, Detroit's a much different example because it's so big and there's so many people involved besides just the emergency manager himself.
And now there's
he has brought in his own team, and he thinks that he can run it going forward. And we all wish him the very best, and I certainly hope he succeeds.
Just to dovetail off what you were saying, Lou, it is a really unique entity because there's this new Michigan Review, commission that they created just for Detroit. So whereas a city like Pontiac will have a TAB board, a Transition Advisory Board, there's a law that shows, and it's part of the grand bargain.
Yes, it's good.
Detroit, you're not going to get a TAB. You're going to get something a little different with a 13-year limit on it and all these other bells
and
whistles.
Much the way that New York City had.
Control
board. And the state has a lot of skin in the game.
The state has a lot of skin in the game, and it's a huge amount of money.
What do you think, based on what you've seen, Chastity, as you've dug into the law, how it's working in Michigan, how it compares elsewhere? What do you see for Detroit after Kevin Orr leaves?
There's going to be this review commission, and the real big question is, how is this review board, this control board for all intents and purposes, going to play out? Is it going to be another layer of bureaucracy? Is it going to be more political gameplay now between the state and the city as to how the city should run? Those questions are, we haven't seen the commission appointed yet, but those are the questions that we're putting forth beforehand to sort of, keep everybody's eye on the ball. We need cooperation, and we need sustainability moving forward. So really, how do we get there? And also, there's this lawsuit that the NAACP has filed. We're assuming that the Public Act 436 is going to stick and stay, and that, this is going to proceed how it's been laid out. At any rate, again, the questions that I think everyone needs to keep in mind that we laid out is, how do we sustain this? How do we minimize the gameplay? This is a lot of money, a lot of people's lives.
Chastity Pratt-Dossie, her story on Michigan's EM Law, is out in today's edition of Bridge Magazine at bridgemi.com. Chastity, thank you so much. And
thanks.
Lou Schimmel, former EM and emergency financial manager for Ecorse, Hamtramck, and Pontiac, and now on Pontiac's Transition Advisory Board. As always, Lou, thank you so much for speaking with us.
I enjoyed it very much. Thanks.
We wrap up our week-long review of the new $53 billion state budget. Today, money for law and order. Detroit Free Press Lansing reporter Kathy Gray is here. Kathy, does this new budget have more or less money to fight crime than last year?
I think that there's some more. There's some technology upgrades that is going to help police fight crime. There's also more money for trooper schools, and that was cut during the Granholm administration just because the budgets were so tight back then. And every year that Snyder has been there, he has had at least one trooper school that has gone through. So there's another one next year and a number of other things.
All right. Well, let's talk about this. What is this? What's the law and order funding part of the budget going to get us?
Okay, it's going to get us another trooper school, which is $12.2 million for 100 more troopers. That's going to be an emergency vehicle, kind of a SWAT type of vehicle, automated fingerprints, which is $2.2 million, and an expansion of electronic warrants for police at $800,000. A helicopter at $5.1 million. That seems kind of expensive, doesn't
Ooh.
It?
Ooh, so, and that could be used, what, not just for crime fighting, but also search and rescue and vehicle chases?
Absolutely. There's also a new state police post in Marshall and about $4.5 million for grants to increase school safety programs in communities that have had high crime rates. And there's also $3 million to help prosecutors with the increase in caseloads on rape cases from all those rape kits that never got tested in Detroit. The state put $4 million in that last year to expedite those tests and are giving prosecutors $3 million to help them with the caseload in prosecuting those cases.
All right. So what this money goes for is to help prosecute based on those kits that have already been tested.
Right, right. And Snyder has said that he hopes that the remaining kits will be tested, I think, by next May. That's a lot of caseloads that could come up as a result of those tests.
What else should we watch for then in as far as what we might be getting for our law and order dollars?
Well, there was some additional bills that were passed that didn't necessarily have money attached to it. There was some trio of bills that will make it harder for people to buy the components that go into methamphetamine. And that's become a real huge crisis in the state. So that's one of the areas. There's a bunch of bills that have been introduced, but I don't think that they've gone all the way through passage on human trafficking to cut down on those types of things. So that's some more law and order type stuff that we can expect to see in before the end of the year.
Detroit Free Press Lansing reporter Kathy Gray. Always a pleasure talking with you, Kathy. Thank you so much.
Thanks Cindy.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Ellie Billings, Emily Fox, Taylor Mattia, Kayla Steinberg, Katie Suha, and Michelle Hun. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.